This is the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are talking with Brian Greene. We are talking about the universe. No small task.
We're talking about everything.
We are, and theories thereof. We were reminded not long ago by one of the world's great instrumentalists, who happens to play a stringed instrument, that music is the first discipline. Isn't it sort of embarrassing to come all the way back and be talking about strings?
Well, I don't find it embarrassing. I find it wonderful that this idea that, you know, humankind appears on Earth and shortly thereafter, so does music. And now, as we try to understand how the universe is put together, we're led to make use of musical metaphors in a way that brushes up really tightly against reality, at least according to the theories. Because, as I was quickly mentioning before, the strings and string theory really vibrate in a manner that intuitively can be thought of in terms of how strings on a violin or any other stringed instrument vibrate. And the association between vibrational patterns in music and vibrational patterns in physics, giving rise to particle and particle properties, I think is one of the more compelling aspects of the theory.
We just sort of went past. I want to share some of these Alice moments.
Alice in Wonderland.
We went past quantum mechanics fairly quickly. I said early on that relativity has been a challenge, but this is well beyond that. And what string theory does, of course, is bring relativity, gravity, together with quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics, on the other hand, is a real challenge. I mean, most of us, and we come across it in Heisenberg uncertainty that people misquote all the time, wave-particle duality that people, you know, are still sort of mystified, some of the strange behaviors of solid objects that are very mysterious. I think it was a Feynman that said, anybody that says they understand it
probably doesn't understand it.
Not even in the range. But what you're talking about is something that brings those two fields together, but does it in very mysterious ways.
May I just say, Feynman is Richard Feynman, who is one of the great thinkers in your business,
right,
in the century.
Absolutely.
Share with us some of those. I mean, let me, there's some things that were striking, just as an example. The notion that perhaps using string theory and assuming that the dimensions we're familiar with are in fact curved, but curved on a very large scale, that in fact that curvature allows the world, the universe, which is a mysterious word now, to actually close back on itself, and that the end of the universe and the beginning of the universe may well be the same place.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Did I get that right?
Yeah, there's a lot of
that's a bit of a challenge.
Welcome to Wonderland!
Right. This is the gingham dog and the calico cat.
Right. Well, you're right. Quantum mechanics is perhaps the strangest feature of any physical theory, although we know it has to be incorporated in any theory of the world because it works experimentally incredibly well. And I think it's worth noting that Einstein himself was never too happy with quantum mechanics.
It offended him,
and he felt that the old one, meaning the fellow upstairs, would not have constructed the universe based on such strange ideas.
He didn't like probability much either.
That's right.
So God doesn't play dice.
Yeah, one of the features of quantum mechanics is that, unlike Newton's perspective, in which the universe can be likened to an enormous cosmic clock, which has this reliable, regular mechanism that evolves according to fixed laws, you wind it up and you let it go and you can predict exactly what will happen in the future, quantum theory says the best you can ever hope to do is predict how the universe will evolve according to the likelihood that it will end up in some outcome. 50% chance of this outcome, 34% chance of that, and so forth. And Einstein just felt, look, that's not how physics works. Physics should tell us what will happen, not the probability that something or something else is going to happen. He spent a long time, perhaps the last three decades of his own life, trying to avoid that feature
So those of us who want to avoid it are in good company.
That's right, you're
is
very
that what
good
you're
company.
Saying?
Exactly, because these are strange features. We don't encounter in the world around us probability except if we go to Las Vegas or if we, you know, go to the horse track. But quantum theory says that probability is injected into the world on a far more deep level.
It says
that
we really do encounter it.
We do encounter it, except that it occurs in realms that we don't typically enter into because it really shows its head more clearly in the microscopic domain. But what happens in the microscopic affects what happens in the world around us. So fundamentally, the world evolves according to rules of probability. And that is so foreign from our day-to-day experience that it's hard to wrap your mind around that.
In fairness, you know, thinking through that, though, there was a time when the notion of sailing east to get west was also very strange. The notion that the surface of the Earth, which appears to be flat, an XY surface, was in fact curved, and that you could go one way and end up in the other direction. So, you know, we've had to make these adaptations before. I think what is different now is that the remarkable rate of transition, the remarkable progress that has been made in this century, and not to take anything away from the preliminary work, particularly the mathematical work that was done over the last 200 or 300 years. But the rate of change is just awesome. I mean, it used to be you had a little time to absorb
right.
the theories. And now it is. It seems that I had a sense reading through that there was a very much an on the one hand, on the other hand, if then you know yebit.
That's a technical term, yebit.
The yebit
it's
theory.
It's in the glossary.
It must be in the physics glossary. and thank you for putting that glossary in. It helped. But that just constant, you know, you get to a certain point and you think you've got your hands around it and you've got the mathematics relatively intractable, but it feels like you're in the right domain. And then something comes at you.
Yeah. I mean, there's a good story about Lord Kelvin, who at the end of the last century, the end of the 19th century, felt that we had come to the end of science in terms of the basic ideas, and all that was left was filling in a few details that would affect, you know, the digits after the decimal point, you know, way down the line, just fine details. And that was before the discovery of special relativity, before the discovery of general relativity, before the discovery of quantum mechanics, and of course, before our current work on string theory. And the world as we now see it, at least in our theories, is so different from the conception that was put forward as a final explanation back at the end of the last century. And one can only suspect, you know, at the end of the next century or the one after, they may look back at us and say, wow, what a parochial little view they had of how the world is put together.
That's a real important notion, because it may well be that you're just, you talk about the risk a physicist takes of spending their life on the wrong track.
Not only could it be the wrong track, it could be potentially right, but it's such a small piece of a grander tapestry that we might be just filling in one little thread in some gigantic, wonderful tapestry of how the universe is put together.
One small ant, just sort of pushing around crumbs.
Right.
The provisional nature of knowledge, you know, specifically with respect to what you do, just the incremental steps that you go through, but generalizing that, you know, just in that century, looking at physics, which is about as tangible as it gets, in some senses, is very humbling. You know, because these are tangible and up to a certain point testable conditions, circumstances, and to have the kind of provisional, equivocal even, nature of knowledge is just from an epistemological standpoint very humbling. I mean, the sense is that you don't want to go too far out on a limb asserting that this is the absolute truth, that there's always a possibility that there's something else out there.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I guess there are two things that come to mind on that. The first is, although the history of science has been one of refuting previous ways of thinking about things and coming up with new theories, oftentimes the new doesn't actually erase the old. It just shows that the old wasn't a complete story, and that we needed to add additional things. And sometimes those additional things require major upheavals in our understanding. But it's often the case that you can trace an intellectual history that absolutely required those initial steps before those subsequent ones could be taken. The second thing is that, having said, which I think needs to be said, that our current work maybe is wrong, maybe is off the mark, or maybe is just one step on a more grand path, there's nothing at the moment that indicates that that's the case. Everything points toward this actually being a final explanation of things. And I say that with hesitation, because we have not completed the theory yet. But it's rather surprising to us in the field that it's been around for this many years, and as yet, it still is standing, and it still has the same potential to explain the universe that we thought it might even 15 years ago. And our current work only bolsters our hope that this will be potentially one of the final steps in the quest to understand the fundamental workings of the universe.
In that context, you talk about two revolutions in string theory. Can you just that 25 or fewer words, tell us what those were?
Sure. The first revolution in string theory occurred roughly between 1984 and 1986. And that's when two physicists, one by the name of John Schwartz and the other by Michael Green, no relation to me at all, who were working on string theory in rather obscurity for the last 10 years prior to 84. Nobody took their work seriously. They showed in 84 that one of the key problems that was afflicting the theory could be resolved. And that really opened up the possibility that this could be a theory of our world. And really, worldwide, physicists jumped into working on string theory. That's when I was a grad student. I started it in 84, so it was sort of the perfect time.
We're riding a wave.
That's right. Get in on the ground
floor. Timing, right. And timing.
Right, exactly. The second string revolution occurred in 1995, and perhaps we're still living through it. It's always hard when you're in a revolution to know when it ends. But it was marked by a whole new set of whole new ways of understanding string theory that go beyond approximations that had to be done in the 80s. The equations of string theory are really complicated. The mathematics is really complicated, and often we approximate things without doing them exactly because it's too darn hard to do the exact analysis. In the 1990s, through the second superstring revolution, we found means of being far more accurate, going beyond the approximations and doing exact calculations, and that has opened up features of the theory that were obscure previously.
We're going to be back in just a moment with more about the universe and physics, and then can we talk a little bit about math, too?
Sure.
This is Dr. Brian Green, Bill Russell, and I. She wants to talk about math? Oh, well, when we come back, we'll see where that goes. Just a moment, please. We'll be back shortly.